we're back with another installment of the GEQUO Campaign's Podcast for Parity. Thanks again to American University's Academy on Human Rights and Humanitarian Law for setting this up. As you all know, International Women's Day is on March 8th, and as part of a week-long celebration, we've been featuring the advisors who have propelled us forward in our quest to change the picture and promote gender parity in international justice. Today, we will be speaking with Nanny Jensen Reventlow. She is an internationally recognized human rights lawyer responsible for groundbreaking freedom of expression cases across several national and international jurisdictions. Nanny has represented clients before the African Court on Human and People's Rights, the East African Court of Justice, and at the European Court of Human Rights. Nanny is also the former legal director of the Media Legal Defense Initiative, MLDI, has written multiple scholarly articles, and developed training sessions for lawyers from diverse jurisdictions. You can check out more of her work at www.nannyjensen.org. And Nanny, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I wanted to start a little bit with your story. What drove you to become a human rights lawyer and specifically a specialist focused on freedom of expression?
Well, I guess that has been a combination of natural interests. I found public international law a fascinating mix of law, international relations, and in a way also economics when I was in law school, and probably also the kind of cliché-sounding desire to make a difference. If I'm going to spend the majority of my time on this earth working, I would like for it to serve some sort of purpose. And that's not to say that there's no selfish element in any of this. I was really enjoying, I really enjoy practicing in this field of law, which is, of course, also very important. And the freedom of expression bit actually happened more or less by accident. A friend alerted me to an opening with the Media Legal Defense Initiative when I was looking to make the switch from corporate law to human rights, in which I originally trained. The job sounded great. While I never really thought about freedom of expression before that time, it sounded interesting. So I read up on the topic before my interview, and I was lucky enough to be hired.
And so, given your very diverse experience, because you also worked in the corporate sector and you've worked in freedom of expression and human rights, what exactly sparked your interest in the GEQUO campaign?
Well, one of the topics that I actually had always been interested in was women's rights. That was actually the focus of a lot of my a lot of the courses that I took while I was in law school and also when I did my LLM. So that, combined with the kind of special interest that I always have for equality issues and, of course, my interest in the law, made it a really good fit. I was kind of shocked, actually, when I got involved in the campaign to see how bad the numbers were, that women's representation in especially international courts and tribunals was so shockingly low.
And so you worked at MLDI, which focuses on helping journalists worldwide defend their rights. And what are some of the key challenges that female journalists face in today's day and age?
I guess if you look at like the modern day problems of journalists, I think that both male and female journalists alike are experiencing increasing degrees of online abuse, especially as more and more publishing, more and more publishing outlets are moving online. But one thing that stands out for female journalists and for women in general, I suppose, who take a public stance on matters, is the sexualized natures of the threats that they receive, the threats of violence. There's threats of rape and other types of sexual abuse, and those are generally targeted at women journalists and not their male colleagues. Of course, this is part of a much wider problem that's related to general issues such as, you know, cyber harassment.
And so how do you think an increased female perspective in international justice can help address these challenges?
Well, the issue of cyber harassment, trolling, and all of those things is very complex. And I wish that I had the answer on how to deal with it, but I don't. And I actually think that nobody does at this stage. Otherwise, I would really love to hear it. What I can say is that it's clear from the offline world that women can make a very special contribution to the international justice system. The example I often mention is that women have played a crucial role. Female judges have played a crucial role in getting rape recognized as a war crime. And I can only say that the time will hopefully tell what contribution women can make in this specific sphere.
And so you mentioned the numbers in your previous response. You know, we look at the UN Special Rapporteurship on Freedom of Expression, and in the history of this rapporteurship, out of the four members, only there have been no women among the representation. And so how do you think this has impacted the capacity of this entity to holistically address key issues in the field and hold governments to account for human rights violations? And do you have any examples that might speak to those challenges?
Mm-hmm. Well, I only know the two most recent UN Special Rapporteurs on Freedom of Expression, and they're both excellent. They have exercised, and David Kaye is still exercising, their mandate in an exemplary fashion, which is not easy, of course, given the subject matter, which is really broad, and also the limited resources that Special Rapporteurs have available in general. But that notwithstanding, I would certainly hope that the next mandate holder will be a woman. I'd like to think that whoever that is would maybe follow the example that is now being set by the new UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, Agnes Callamard. When she started her mandate, she called for input to taking a gender-sensitive approach to exercising all aspects of her mandate. And I think that should be the standards, really, that a gender-sensitive approach is part and parcel of the way in which special mandates fulfill their tasks, no matter what gender they identify with themselves.
Tell us about your work at the Harvard Cyber Law Clinic. Broad strokes, how do you think a greater representation of women in international bodies can impact the development of cyber law? And you just mentioned trolling as a bit of a difficult example to pinpoint, but trolls do tend to have a very particular way of going after women. And so how could gender balance really have a key input in this developing field of law?
Mm-hmm. Well, the projects I'm working on at the Cyber Law Clinic focus on human rights and technology, freedom of expression in the broadest sense. And I think, you know, what I said earlier about international justice equally applies here, in the sense that women indeed will have a special role to play in this. I think one of the things to mention here in particular is that women are particularly underrepresented, right, in the field of technology. That applies, of course, unfortunately, to a really long list of professional spheres. And you are right. There's a particular approach, as you very tactfully said, to the trolling of women. It's very aggressive, and it's often highly sexualized in nature when it comes to threats of violence. I think what a gender balanced perspective can bring to this is the fact that I think it's not being taken as seriously as it should be, and also what the impact is that this kind of harassment can have on individuals. And I would actually hope that indeed, if you have a more balanced representation, amongst the people that deal with this and who are trying to think of solutions, and hopefully at some point also kind of maybe find out ways to kind of enforce any kind of mechanisms that you can come up with. Yeah, basically to kind of give this issue its appropriate weight.
So given your distinguished trajectory, do young female lawyers ever ask how you charted your path, and what advice do you or would you give them, and what impact can GQL have for all lawyers? And I'm asking this because we're also broadcasting this podcast at American University. What advice would you give these young lawyers that are just carving out their careers?
Okay. Well, I get asked the question from time to time, and I'm always really happy to speak to young lawyers, because I can remember just a little too well how difficult it was to get started in the type of career that I wanted to have, which was one in human rights. And unfortunately, there are just a whole lot of people out there who aren't super supportive of young women pursuing, you know, the vision or the ambitions that they have for their professional lives. I suppose the advice I generally give people can be summed up as you know, be both persistent and flexible. So persistent in pursuing what you want, but also flexible in realizing that there are very many, many ways of getting there, and that the path might not always be a very linear one. And I think another thing that I would probably add to that is don't let anyone tell you something can't be done. Many people kind of lack imagination, right, to do anything that's not preset. They think in preset jobs and careers, in preset boxes / labels. And it's really important to remember to not let other people's lack of imagination kind of hold you back. And on GECO and the impact that the campaign can have, and I hope that it will have, I think it's really difficult to overestimate how important the campaign is. You know, you use the hashtag change the picture, and I think that that basically sums it up. Because the picture that we currently see at international bodies is one that basically says that a woman's seat at the table is really hard to come by, and there's no place for you women, and young lawyers will kind of subconsciously internalize that. So by literally changing the picture, I believe that many more young female lawyers can be encouraged to pursue careers in those spaces and actually make their voice heard.
And beautifully said. I feel inspired. And I'm sure everybody listening to this will feel equally inspired to get out there and get on the human rights GECO bandwagon. And so this is our final question. Across the globe, organizers are calling for an international women's strike on March 8th to build a feminism for the 99%. So it's a feminism in solidarity with working women, their families, and their allies throughout the world. And in light of the goals of the strike, we're asking our participants in this podcast the following. How do you think the absence of women in international spaces affects the so-called 99%, and conversely, how can the presence of women in international justice strengthen a feminism for the 9%?
I think the main problem that I have with the absence of women is that it creates a serious legitimacy problem. International courts, tribunals, international organizations, they all make crucial decisions on international justice, on economic development, human rights, and all sorts of really important things. You cannot really have a legitimate justice or rule-creating system that doesn't include a broad cross-section of the society in which it's operating. And women make up more than half of the world's population, yet they are fundamentally underrepresented in these forums. And they deserve to be equally represented in all of those spaces, including this one. And I think that changing that will have a significant impact on justice for women and also for the overall feminist cause.
Nani, thank you so much for joining us today. If you'd like to know more about Nani, visit her website at www.nanijohnson.org.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much.